All right, welcome to another Tad Pod. I'm Kyle Martino. I'm here with producer Mike. PM joining me in the booth. An international break has come. It is gone. Premier League is back this weekend, but we're going to stay with the international game. We're going to talk U.S. soccer. And PM, you were there. You
were at the game. I made it out of Red Bull
Arena
alive.
Not in Honduras.
No, I was not in Honduras, but I was in New Jersey, and it was not a good Friday to start off my weekend.
Well,
I don't want to. We have a great job. I don't want to complain about my job, but we work weekends.
Yeah.
You have a free weekend.
You want to enjoy it.
You want to take full advantage of it.
You want to have some beers. You want to watch your team win.
Seeing the U.S. lose at home to Costa Rica on a
not
Friday
fun.
Night? No.
We're going to get into that. We got three topics today. They're all U.S. soccer focused. We're going to have a sort of macro conversation about what's going on with U.S. soccer. Where are we in the process and what's sort of ahead? We're going to take a micro look into the Costa Rica game, the Honduras game, and sort of dissect both of those performances a little bit. And then first, we're going to get into what Mike was alluding to. We're going to get into a topic that has become controversial that I've seen a lot of conversation on Twitter about. I've listened to a couple podcasts about it. My buddy Hercules Gomez, if you don't listen to Max and Herc is the name of the podcast. He and Bretos, two great soccer voices, two good friends that are doing an awesome job on their podcast. So give them a listen. But, he had an interesting take on it that I'll get into a little bit. But before we get into all that, let me hit those reviews. You guys keep doing it. You keep giving us these great reviews, and we love it. Thank you so much, Tad Potters, for humoring us, not only giving good reviews, but great soccer moments. So I picked out my three favorite. And if you're new to the Tad Pod, we do this every week. We have you guys give us reviews. Most of the time you give us good ones, which is great, but you can give us bad ones if you want. You just have to include a great soccer moment, a sort of pivotal moment in your journey as a soccer fan. And let me read my three favorite from the past week. This is Lando Calrissian 17, The Miracle in Istanbul is the subject. Kyle brings a fresh and entertaining take on all major happenings around the beautiful game. This has a shot to be a top football podcast of mine every week. As for the moment that I fell in love with the game, I started following the EPL in 2004-05 season. As I looked for a club to truly follow, I quickly grew intrigued with Liverpool and the epic history that had albeit recently disappointing events. Watching Gerrard week in and week out will still be some of my favorite EPL moments, but surely nothing can top that amazing Champions League night in Istanbul. AC Milan with Crespo, Kaká, Pirlo, and Maldini were absolutely majestic in the first half, but the fight that Liverpool had that night was truly awe-inspiring, and watching them fight back from three goals down and push Milan to the brink and force that epic penalty shootout was ultimately the amazing game that led to a Champions League victory. Easily the moment that made me fall in love with this sport and continue watching until today. Cheers, mate. Continue the awesome show. That was an insane night.
That game was so good.
I remember where I was. I was in Holland with the under-20 U.S. team. We were playing in a tournament, and six of us. I see some of the faces right now. I think it was like Kyle Beckerman and Edson Buttle and Connor Casey. We were all gathered around the TV. And some guys had left. Some guys left at halftime because I think it was later. No, we were in the same time zone. So, yeah, it was just the game was late at night. I think we had a game the next day. A lot of guys hit the sack. And we sat there and watched that comeback. It was insane. One of the coolest Champions League finals ever.
I remember that sort of expanded beyond the small soccer community of that time period. Because I was on a college campus. Everyone knew me as the soccer guy.
Yeah.
And people who didn't care about the game saw the highlights. And they were like, is that one of the best games ever? And the answer was yes.
That's one of those catch-all nets that like gets people that aren't necessarily soccer fans super psyched. What a cool moment. Next one, Capo 40858-5612. That's a lot of numbers. So pleased to hear you back for season two. It's funny. It's like it was like picked back up. Yeah. We got picked up for season two.
We got renewed.
Always insightful. My moment was Wijnaldum free kick at 94 World Cup at Silverdome. That was cool. Maybe the denim kit helped, but I'll never forget that moment as a young boy. 94, there's a lot of 94 moments. We were talking, I think it was last pod, we were talking about our 94 moment. Keep your 94 moments coming because that was cool. I mean, the denim kit can be excused. But
I was rocking that Friday night. It didn't help us.
Oh, did you really? Yeah. I wore jersey Friday night. Yeah, no. I wore one for the Honduras game. I almost never wear a U.S. jersey for U.S. games. I wear them during the World Cup. I reserve it for, mm-hmm. for the big moments. And I threw one on. I threw the terrible bomb pop, you know, the red, blue, and
oh, I like that one.
I mean, it's tough to look at.
It's right in your face.
It's up there with denim with the denim kit from 94.
Yeah.
I chucked it on, and it didn't help for the Honduras game. Although, maybe it did. We'll get into that. Last one, and then we're going to get on to this. Butter and Calcio. This is from PGH fan. When I hear Kyle's butterly baritone voice talking football, it takes me back to getting pelted with Roman candle debris, sitting in Curva Fiesole circa 2004 when I saw my beloved Fiorentina draw 1-1 with Perugia to secure a spot in the top flight. The players stripped down to undies and cleats. We rushed the pitch and celebrated all night in the city center. From then on, I was hooked on this game. I mean, that's a pretty...
That's about as best. I think that's as good as we've heard,
yeah.
Specifically.
I mean, that's a more visceral, like, he was there and yeah. It was insane moment. Super cool. Keep those coming, Tad Potters. Thanks for the reviews. Thanks for the stories. All right, let's get into it. The stadium / crowd conversation. So this has become a sensitive topic because it raises two touchy issues, and let me debunk both of those. The first is the sort of cultural idea that... and let me paint the picture. The game was at Red Bull Arena, 15, 20 minutes outside of New York City. Big metropolitan game, which rarely, rarely happens, and we'll get into why that's the case. And the crowd, it's full to the rafters. I remember the beginning of the game, I was sitting at home, Mike, and you helped paint the picture of what it was like in there. And the buildup was excellent. You know, they had all the little cards on the seats that everyone lifted up that made this amazing TIFO before the game, red, white, and blue, and stars, and the buildup felt very, very electric, very positive, and it was an amazing, amazing soccer environment. It was, though, seeming from home, sort of a 50-50 environment of Costa Rican fans and U.S. fans. Is that accurate, or what was...
I would say it was more about 65%. U.S.
Okay,
but those Costa Ricans that are there, that are hitting that price point, those tickets are not cheap.
Yeah,
those are diehard fans,
and they were amazing.
They got energized quickly.
Yeah. So as far as qualifying goes, as kind of even as stadiums get when the U.S. plays, it's not about Costa Ricans or dual citizens or Americans with Costa Rican heritage. Having a right to be there, or an entitlement that they shouldn't be there, or a resentment to U.S. fans for not filling more of those seats. It has absolutely nothing to do with that. In terms of atmosphere, the Costa Ricans make that a better atmosphere. I mean, in a one-off soccer game, in a friendly, that's exactly where you want to play Costa Rica, because it's the biggest concentration of people either coming from that country, who had parents from that country. I mean, that is a hotbed for Costa Rican pride and culture. And to be able to see their team in the flesh is a rare thing for them. So an amazing opportunity. And I thought they were incredible. And I give them so much credit for showing up. And to your point, not cheap to make it to that night. And to show up and support their team the way they did was remarkable. They have every right to do that. It's one of the cool things about our country is how multicultural we are. And we can create an atmosphere like that in major metropolitan cities. You can go watch U.S. play in the Rose Bowl and it be filled with 60,000 fans of the Mexican national team. I mean, that's super cool in terms of a soccer environment. But that's not what this is about. This is about qualifying for a World Cup. So what that atmosphere did was give an advantage to Costa Rica and a disadvantage to the United States. Because the Costa Rican team must have felt great in that stadium. And I'll compare it to the contrast of what it's like to travel on the road and tell sort of personal story about going to Costa Rica and playing in a World Cup qualifier there. But it has nothing to do with the cultural thing. The Costa Rican fans absolutely should have showed up, and I would have been surprised and maybe a bit angry that they didn't, because, I mean, that's their team. Go support them. And you had to absolutely expect they would. Mm-hmm. So it has absolutely nothing to do about the cultural thing. I mean, that's the beauty, again, about this melting pot we live in, that there are the colorful cultures that we have, the different tastes, sounds, and ideas, all blend together to make this a better country. And in terms of soccer, make it a more passionate soccer environment. So amazing that they showed up. And in a one-off game, that's exactly what I want. I kind of want to go to see a game in an atmosphere like that. But that's not what this is about. So I'm going to get onto the next sensitive issue, and then we'll sort of unpack this a bit. The next sensitive issue is this is a slight on U.S. soccer fans and a slight on American Outlaws. I had said something about, you know, U.S. soccer made a big mistake having this game here, and talked about, you know, the American Outlaws being this incredible group that isn't being utilized the right way by putting them in a stadium where they're going to have to compete so much against the opposition fans. And you know, someone on Twitter came at me saying it's a criticism of the American Outlaws. No, it's not. It has nothing to do with U.S. fans. U.S. fans showed up. As you said, the majority of the stadium was U.S. Yeah. fans. When the U.S. team were playing well, the American Outlaws were the only ones I heard. And the American Outlaws, the only complaint I have about them is that they were created after I stopped playing. I mean, I would love to play in front of those guys. I honestly think, and this is not biased to soccer, they are the best fan-supporting group in America. Mm. There is no other sport that can mobilize fans like the American Outlaws can. Because of that, give them an advantage to do that in a place where they are going to absolutely dominate, even when our team isn't performing great. That's why Columbus became such a important place for the most difficult game in CONCACAF against Mexico. You wouldn't have the game against Mexico at the Rose Bowl in World Cup qualifying. Of course not. And the reason that this was a rare thing for U.S. soccer to put the game in New York is because they know that. They know this gives the traveling team an advantage. And that's what this is about. This isn't about, you know, political, cultural things. This isn't a criticism of U.S. fans. It has absolutely nothing to do about that. It's about getting to a World Cup. And to get to a World Cup, you have to win your home qualifiers. That's how you get to World Cups. In any region, in any part of the world, that's how you get to a World Cup. You win your home games. And we have a unique challenge in this country because of the things I just talked about in a positive way, the multicultural aspect of our country. It's a challenge that other regions don't have, which is trying to find places where you can protect against what's naturally going to happen, which is fans of the opposition team can easily make it to the stadiums in metropolitan areas. And that's why you hardly ever see World Cup qualifiers in metropolitan areas. And you see people saying they want them in Kansas City, they want them in Columbus, they want them in, you know, in Seattle or Portland, where you can generate a very dominant American fan base. The disparity is remarkable in terms of how hard it is for the U.S. to travel. Look at that Honduras game, and we'll get into that. Go to Saprissa, go to Azteca, and how easy it is for teams to travel and play in stadiums in the States. So U.S. soccer, I don't care if it's as trivial as the stadium sprinkler system isn't working and we play better when the grass is wet. Do absolutely everything you can to control that environment to give the United States the best possible advantage. And let me tell you a story about playing on the road in CONCACAF. I played in a World Cup qualifier at Saprissa Stadium. They don't play them anymore there, fortunate for the U.S., because it was terrifying. From the second you get there, you're uncomfortable where you get to the hotel because fans are outside making it difficult for you to get into the stadium. They pull the fire alarms in the middle of the night to wake you up. I mean, these aren't the sort of fairy tales. This actually happens.
And this is Costa Rica, which is a tourist center.
Which is amazing to go to as a non-soccer
with
player.
With lovely people.
Yeah, which is one of the one places I want to go to every time I have time off.
Yeah.
But when you get there, it's volatile from the moment you get there. You drive up to the stadium. You need a police escort, of course, to get in, which you typically do on the road anyway. But you need a police barricade to get into the stadium because people are throwing things at you. You get into the stadium. You sit in the locker room. Plaster's falling down on your head because people are jumping in the stands. You go out there. They have huge fences that are like 20 feet high to keep people from literally coming onto the field. You stand there during the national anthem. They boo during your national anthem. And at that game, there were signs that said, we hope your troops die, and all sorts of awful things that like make you so remarkably uncomfortable. Mm. And then we got our asses handed to us out there, which shouldn't have surprised anyone because Costa Rica is very good, but on their home turf, we are so uncomfortable as you can possibly be in a soccer environment, just like at the Azteca when the U.S. go down there. So when the team travels to come see us and half of the stadium is their fans, that's such a disparity. You have to be able to, and I'm going to go a little long on this because you're showing me the time, and I'm just going to power through. You have to control every little tiny thing you can. Players are creatures of habit. I mean, players, they control with their club team every little thing they do. You know, I mean, there are a lot of guys that eat the same thing the day of, take the same way to the stadium, sit in the same seat, put the same song on, put their shoes on the same way. I mean, that's how crazy a lot of soccer players are, athletes in general. You have to give them every possible advantage you can so that they can succeed on the field. And putting them at Red Bull Arena was a big mistake because there was nowhere in this country the U.S. could have played Costa Rica that would have made Costa Rica feel more comfortable than playing in that stadium or in the New York City area. So that being said, we didn't lose the game because of the crowd. As I said before, you know, if the U.S. played better longer, I thought in the first half they were actually pretty good during stretches. All I heard was the American Outlaws. And that's what happens is you beat opposition fans by outperforming their team. The difference is when we're in Honduras or we're in Costa Rica or we're in Mexico, and it's amazing that the American Outlaws could get as many people as they can, but you know, we're talking maybe 1,000 fans, like at most, that travel to, and usually it's a couple hundred fans,
yeah,
which is amazing that they can make it all the way down there. They can make it to these games, that they go to support their team. But when the U.S. is playing well on the road, the crowd doesn't become overpowered, yeah, with
no
U.S.
Olé
chants and olés and stuff like, yeah, that. That doesn't happen. But it happened at Red Bull Arena. There were olés going on in the second half. I mean, that impacts you as a player. That affects you. Mm. You're supposed to be this hard guy that clears the mechanism and zones it out. That doesn't happen. You are absolutely affected by the crowd. And if that's true, then you always have to put the U.S. team in the best possible stadium you can to make them dominant. That's why, and there are challenges why we can't do it. That's why Mexico plays at Azteca almost every single qualifier. I mean, they make that a cauldron, a fortress that when you go in, you remember the last time you were there. All the fans remember, the Mexican fans remember the great moments that they've had there. I mean, you lose kind of the game before you've even stepped out onto the field in many respects. That's why it's so remarkably difficult to beat them down there. Now, it's hard for us to build that in the States because of many challenges. One is when U.S. players are coming from Europe, you know, when they fly into New York or they fly into a major city, last thing you want them to do is have to now connect and go somewhere further and take them to these places that's a bit of a disadvantage because our players are having to travel further and take smaller flights and get to these areas.
That's a point that people don't think about. I'm glad that you make that point.
Yeah.
I never would have thought of that.
It's not without its challenges, but that problem I would take over and get the team to Columbus rather than have them go to Red Bull Arena, and the second the game starts slipping through their hands or they start not performing well or you know, God forbid, concede a goal like they did against Costa Rica, against the run of play, now all of a sudden, I mean, this you feel like you're not on home soil anymore. And so people need to just stop with the politically correct arguments. It's not about that. It has absolutely nothing about it. It has to do with competition. In a friendly scenario, I'm the first to say play that at Red Bull because you want to make money. You want to make sure you fill it, which is why U.S. soccer did it. You want it to be an amazing atmosphere, and you want your rivals to have a good fan base. You know, you want them, when they're playing well, for that crowd to get after it. So that atmosphere was amazing, and as a soccer fan, I loved it, and I thought it was incredible, and I would have loved to have been there. But as someone that wants to see the U.S. make it to a World Cup, which has to be goal one and the only goal, you don't have a game against Costa Rica. You don't have a game against CONCACAF teams in major cities where you struggle to be the dominant supporting force in the stands.
Okay, no whistle this time. I wasn't even going to give it to you.
Yeah, I had to power through that because I was amazed that became such a sensitive issue, and it seems to be such a simple idea.
Yeah.
I mean, well, it's simple. It's binary. Are you going to the World Cup or aren't you? to get there, you need every advantage that you possibly can, especially now that the U.S. isn't as dominant in CONCACAF as they've been in the past. And also because of how important it is for the U.S. to get to a World Cup. I argue that the United States getting to a World Cup is more important than any other nation. Missing a World Cup is more detrimental to the game in this country than it is anywhere else. Now, you know, people would say in the Netherlands, missed out on Euros, missing out on a World Cup after that would be devastating. Absolutely right. I mean, that's a remarkably passionate country that's going to be devastated, and there's going to be huge waves and repercussions for them not qualifying for a World Cup. But the game's not going to struggle at all. Yeah. It's not going to be detrimental to the game. We are still at a point with this game in this country. I remember in 2002 with that great World Cup performance, Clint Mathis and those guys on The Tonight Show. That never happened before. To break into pop culture and to be relevant and important in a massive way. Soccer's obviously relative and important in this country. But to continue to hook the great young athletes, to continue to hook the fans, the United States has to be playing in the biggest sporting tournament in the world. If they miss that, it is devastating. So again, it goes back to qualify for the World Cup at all costs. And at all costs means maybe not making as much money as you can by playing in a smaller stadium in a more rural area, but making sure that you don't give an advantage to your competitor, who, by the way, could go to the World Cup instead of you. So that's that on the stadium. Let's get into what the real issue was, because as I said, it wasn't the crowd. I mean, I know it's kind of it sounds contradictory, but it's not mutually exclusive. You can think the U.S. could have been better set up by being in a different stadium and also think that that's not why they lost, it isn't.
Having been there, there was a lot of Costa Rican support. There was a lot of U.S. support.
A lot. And the American Outlaws at the beginning of that
phenomenal.
Game were remarkable. And these guys, that's the power of the American Outlaws is they can mobilize. They can get fans anywhere. But the thing is, they can't win the game for you. You know, they can get loud, they can be supportive, they can even support you during down stretches, but you have to perform. Mm-hmm. And in the most crucial areas, the U.S. didn't perform in the game against Costa Rica. Now, I'm not one of the ones that think they performed as badly as many are saying. I mean, a lot of people were ripping the team afterwards. I think it boils down to, it boils down to a few simple defensive mistakes. Tim Howard, 9 times out of 10, makes that save. 9 times out of 10. I've played with him. I've watched him for a long time. I know him. He makes that save. He slid a little bit too far and over-covered the near post, didn't get the right angle, but also didn't get his feet set to get good jump, because the first problem would have been saved if his footwork was right. If you watch that shot again, which wasn't like a quick shot. Wasn't one of those ones hit through legs that surprised a goalkeeper. He was reaching for it. It was clear the shot was coming. Tim just didn't get his feet set. And Tim would say the same. I'm sure he's absolutely pissed at himself that he didn't make that save. Before that, Tim takes a goal kick. He's coming off of adductor surgery. He's never really been a long goalkeeper. I mean, he doesn't crush the ball. And after surgery, he's lost some yards on it as well. The two center backs, Ream and Jeff Cameron in this situation, did what they're supposed to do. They split to open themselves up to receive a short pass from Tim. But when Tim went to go hit the ball long, they immediately should have been tucking in. They immediately should have realized, hey, Tim isn't getting a lot of distance on these. And he didn't. It barely made it to midfield. And Tim was at the top of the 18. And the ball at midfield isn't challenged. And maybe you could argue there's a foul there, but that's reaching a bit. The first header immediately comes right back down the throat of the U.S. team, and the two center backs are still spread wide and should have been able to, even after that, handle the issue. So that's a simple, terrible defensive mistake that shouldn't happen. Through the game, there was some great great sequences. I remember Ian Dark saying, like, you know, that's lovely football from the U.S. or something, when there was a few moments where they looked excellent. I don't know if you felt that when you were there.
There were a couple. I was in the opposite end, so I was in the end where the first half goal was conceded. So I could see the play develop, and there were a couple passing interchanges once Bradley and Nagby got themselves some space to turn and run at the goal. they were able to get a couple of passing exchanges through, especially with Bobby Wood's holdup play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But from where I was sitting, it looked like, and I'm interested to hear what you have to say, that the midfield for Costa Rica just started
dominated.
Swarming.
Yeah. So here's what they did, which should come as no surprise. They always do it. They mm-hmm. know the U.S. They studied really well, and they were well set up. And just like we were giving credit to Costa Rican fans who were incredible on the day, Costa Rica executed that game plan to perfection. So Bobby Wood, you said, Bobby Wood did so well, especially in the first half, back to the goal. A couple of passes through the lines to him. He got turned, spun his defender, mm-hmm. and the U.S. were even numbers in a scenario where one of the big issues of the game is they didn't capitalize on those moments enough. They were profligate and pretty predictable when it got to the final third in those moments where they broke the press. But the U.S. had to expect a high press. They had to expect that energy and didn't adjust for it, and I don't think we're set up right for it. I think Bruce got the game plan wrong here. The way he started the team, Jeff Cameron and Tim Ream hadn't played a lot together. It was aware. I think that might have actually been the first time they played together. I'll have to look back at that, but I can't remember them.
I looked back at center back pairings for the last 2 years, and they haven't been together.
Yeah. So obviously, that's the most nuanced position out there. An understanding has to be there. And, you know, Jeff Cameron's been performing really well recently, so I'm not surprised he was in the game. Tim Ream is really good with the ball at his feet. Not surprised he was in the game, although he gave a ball away really cheaply at the beginning. So even though they don't have a lot of minutes together, it's not surprising they were playing together. But the problem was Michael Bradley is so important to the buildup. And when he couldn't get on the ball, when passing lanes were cut out to him, there was no game. There was no plan B. There was no strategy of, okay, split the center backs, bring Michael Bradley into the back line, have him play as a deep playmaker, and see what Costa Rica do. Get the fullbacks to fly forward. You try to spread out the middle to get the center of the park to say, listen, we're covering space. Now all of a sudden Bradley's not here. The game plan was to crowd him and to hurry him and make sure he can't create tempo and he can't build out of the back. There was no shift. It was basically just, can we continue to force the ball into Michael Bradley, which meant constant turnovers. Mm-hmm. The U.S. were so sloppy with the ball in large stretches of the game because they kept trying to do that. And then all of a sudden you're playing a very narrow 4-4-2. Where Pulisic has plenty of numbers around him and is getting fouled. I mean, they outfouled us 18-10, and majority of those were on Christian Pulisic. Instead of him being in a wide channel like he is when he plays in a 4-3-3 for Dortmund, or having a little freer role to get away from that, the problem ends up being when you play narrow and you say, Christian, stay in the middle of the field, float, because we want you on the ball where you're going to get more touches. You need to possess the ball and get your fullbacks forward so you can get width. We got no width because we couldn't possess the ball because the press for Costa Rica was working so well. And there was just no tactical shift. And the tactical shift I was looking for was halftime.
That was my question. What would you have done?
I would have gone 4-3-3. I would have taken out Johnson, who was having a terrible game. Fabian Johnson was completely non-existent. And I would have put in Kellen Acosta, another body who would help combat a very competitive and very energetic midfield for Costa Rica, but also a capable person on the ball where he, Nagby, and Bradley, between the three of them, I think would have done so much better breaking through that press. And I would have played, if I kept Josie and Wood out there, which I probably would have to begin the second half, I would have pushed Wood out to the left, Pulisic out to the right, and on occasion gone a bit direct into the channels and pushed up behind that, cleared the lines. Now you have ball winners in the center of the park who can help pressurize, and you also are playing a top three that can put that back line under pressure right away. There were so many things that could have been done, and Bruce didn't do any of them.
So not to jump ahead, but that's what they did more or less in the second half against Honduras.
Yeah.
With that, you know, the back line was different.
Mm-hmm.
But that change in formation up top and the three – and they were on the ball a lot.
Yeah, yeah. And it begs the question, you know, Bruce's era so far, the second round, has been marked by improved second-half performances, but it begs the question, as it always does in the game, was that because we didn't start the right way? Start with the right energy, the right formation, the right personnel. And you could make those criticisms if you want, but that was the first game Bruce lost since he's been back. So it's hard to be overly critical of the setup.
Do you think that he was reluctant to make that tactical switch at halftime? Because it seems like when Arena goes into these World Cup qualifiers and there's a pair of games, he really looks at both of them as separate entities. and he didn't want to waste a couple guys, get some, tire their legs out.
It's a really good point. Yeah, it's a really good point. And based on how well it worked in the previous two games where he said that, they were going down to Azteca to play a completely different team, a completely different formation than game one, we commended him and gave him credit for that. So it would be contradictory and hypocritical now to say that was a big mistake, he shouldn't have done that. So that's a really good point. I actually didn't think about that. But the fact of the matter is you can bring on guys for 45 minutes and have them be ready, you know, a few days later. Right. I think the strategy in Honduras was always going to be different because he was going to revert back to MLS-based guys who are used to the conditions, used to the heat, used to playing in CONCACAF. So, you know, that kind of moves us on to the next game, which was a disaster. I mean, the result, excellent and so difficult to get, but just a really poor performance.
It looked far worse than
far worse, but it should in many ways, because it's so much going back to sort of point one about crowd. It is so difficult to go play there. I mean, that grass, do you see how the ball basically dies on it? And it's so difficult for Pulisic. Had a really tough time in the game because he has this move. And I know it because I loved using it, where you get a player off balance. You get a little bit of daylight where you clear him, and as he tries to recover, you touch the ball across his recovery path and cut across him, where he has to either foul you or let you go. Mm-hmm. The problem was the ball kept getting caught up, so the player kept making a challenge on the ball, and Pulisic got stripped about 12 times in that game that way. And I mean, that's just a microcosm of a much bigger issue where playing there is just so difficult. So I'm not surprised, even though the performance was so much worse, I'm not surprised or overly critical of Honduras, because getting a point there was massive, was absolutely massive. And we always say this, and you typically say it, especially players who have been on the road in CONCACAF and know how difficult it is, that's all that really matters. It really is. I mean, it's pointless to overly dissect Honduras. It was a bad performance. The U.S. didn't possess the ball well. They didn't pass the ball well. They looked sluggish. The back line again had a nightmare. It was another center back partnership. Gonzalez had a really poor game, especially on the goal where he made a decision to let the ball roll next to him instead of cutting it out early, thinking he would be able to get on to the end of it and keep possession. He realized, I'm not going to get that. Last-ditch tackle. Beisler hadn't even gotten on his horse yet because he expected Gonzalez to deal with it before that. Then Beisler recovers late, doesn't leave his feet. He stutter steps because he expects a cutback. I mean, the whole thing's a mess. It's a domino effect of terrible defending, which before that, the big issue was our fullbacks. I mean, I love Bees. He was my roommate when I played for the U.S. It's remarkable that he's still going, but it's not good that he's still an option.
Yeah, he's old enough to be Pulisic's father.
It's not good.
And
he was smoked, as was Graham Zusi, who's... That can't be the best option at right back.
We have two converted midfielders playing in the back. I know Beasley's been playing in the back for a while.
In his heyday, Beasley could easily play that position and would be the first choice, no problem. Not anymore at that level.
And I think they're looking behind their shoulders so much on defense, they can't get anything forward. I can't remember a single ball that was whipped in well from one of our outside backs in either game.
No. And because we don't possess the ball, they don't get forward very much. So if that's not going to happen, you have to either play a back three so wingbacks can start with higher positions where you're not as vulnerable when you turn the ball over, or you got to possess the ball better.
Yeah.
And so it'd be one thing if you played with converted backs that you thought, you know what, they're used to CONCACAF. These are guys who've been there, done that. But not against Kyoto and Elias.
Those guys could fly.
Elise? I think it's Elise. I saw those guys in Olympics absolutely tearing the tournament apart. That it's no surprise that they were going to be the major threat, and they were. They completely tore the back line apart. They almost didn't have a striker. They played with sort of a false nine and used those guys in a very wide position. They would interchange, and they tore us apart, and it was to be expected. Another sort of negative mark on Bruce, that he knew that. He had to have known that. And that couldn't, you know, put Jeff Cameron out there at right back. I know he's played the game before. He's been playing a lot of center back. He's been playing in a back three for Stoke, but he's physical. He would have handled that challenge better than Zusi did. And if we're not going to get forward much, you just need someone that's going to stymie the threat of those two guys. I mean, that was Honduras' whole game plan, was to release those guys on counterattacks. So the Costa Rica thing, I didn't think they played as bad as many did, but the result was terrible. The Honduras game, they played terrible, but the result's really good. I mean, getting a point, especially in that game where they weren't playing well, is massive. Not only for our qualification in terms of accruing points, but making sure that Honduras didn't get three. I mean, that would have been a huge win for them and would have put them in the driver's seat. But now the U.S. is still in the driver's seat, which sort of, you know,
is amazing, considering
amazing
their results.
And that brings us on to sort of the macro conversation of kind of where are we? You know, before people pile on and say, listen, you're critical of Jurgen, be critical of Bruce. The criticism of Jurgen was years in the making. I mean, Bruce hasn't even been there, you know, a year. So he's undefeated until they lose to Costa Rica. And has had two bad performances, where the Costa Rica game is a bad performance and he deserves criticism for that. But people forget this team was in a bad position when he took it over and was in had low spirits, was disjointed, was disorganized, lacked cohesion, and he's reverting back to many things in the past that made U.S. teams comfortable, that he knows that works, that might be a little short-term and a little less ambitious, but inevitably puts the U.S. in the best position to qualify for the World Cup, which goes back to the crowd thing. That's goal one. So Bruce still has them with their destiny in their own hands. The U.S. wins their next two games, they're going to the World Cup, right? They have the easiest path in terms of their schedule when you compare to Panama and Honduras and you know, the teams that they're really battling it out for the other spots. Costa Rica and well, Mexico's a lock. And Costa Rica
is all but a lock.
So the U.S. are in good shape, all right? The Panama game in October in Orlando is absolutely massive. And everything hinges on the mistakes that we saw, the issues that are going on. Can they be remedied, and will the team be set up better in that Orlando game to succeed? I'm confident that they will. Bruce is one who definitely is an attention to details sort of guy that learns from his mistakes. You know, he took Tim Howard. That was another one. He took Tim Howard out of the team for the second game in Honduras, saying that he needed to be rested. We had Tim on the podcast, and you haven't listened to it. Listen to Tim's interview before the Costa Rica game. He said that's a farce. Goalkeepers don't need rest.
Episode 17, if you want a reference point.
Yeah. No way that they're just making that up. Goalkeepers need rest. And Bruce said it. So it was. We kind of know what Tim thinks about that already. He should have played in that game because he's the best goalkeeper. And no slight on Brad Guzan. Brad Guzan isn't as good as Tim Howard. You know, soon here, he may surpass, but Tim is still number one. So does Bruce learn, and does the U.S. learn from some easily fixable and avoidable mistakes that happen this time around? One of them, I'll say, is a mistake that plagues the U.S. and has for the last four World Cup cycles, is no established center-back partnership. So, I mean, try to think of some. I mean, Eddie Pope, Jeff Agus, I mean, Bocanegra, Demerit. I mean, there is never a stable number one, number two on the team sheet. These guys are playing center back. If they're healthy, they're our option.
Yeah, I looked back at this, like I said earlier. So in World Cup qualifying, the last five games, we've seen five different pairings. That seems nuts.
That's
to
not
me.
Good. That's not good.
Now, before that, we had Gonzalez and Brooks paired for three straight matches, and that's two Klinsmann, one Arena match. So I don't think that's our first choice back pairing, but I think we all can admit that Brooks is the number one choice. And him being out pretty often, occasionally he pulls muscle, it's hard to get any sort of fluency in that back four. And I think that must have a huge impact on the goalkeeper.
yeah.
and the way that he directs his team, the way that he reacts to certain plays. Mm-hmm. To go back to that first goal that Costa Rica scored, I remember seeing that develop and actually saying out loud, oh, this is nothing, this is nothing. Oh, whoa,
yeah.
that's something.
It should have been, yeah, it should have been nothing.
And I think with a more established partnership between Howard and the center back, they could have worked that out a little bit better.
Yes, and here's the thing. Here's my big macro point. The better the U.S. tries to play and the more ambition we show this progression towards being a team that can put the ball on the ground against the best teams in the world, build out of the back, sort of the Jurgen Klinsmann, you know, promise. The better we try to be, the worse we get at what makes us good. So let me unpack that for a second. What I mean is the U.S. for so long played like an underdog and was a defensively organized, hardworking, sometimes direct, you're gonna have to kill us to beat us team. I mean, that's who the U.S. has been for a very long time. And even in 2002, where we saw sprinkles of a bit more ambition, where they put the ball on the ground against Germany in that massive game in the quarterfinals and you know, against CONCACAF rival in Mexico
yeah.
You know, against Portugal, you know, there were flashes of the team we want to be in those games, but the difference was there was the understanding that it wasn't reality, that who we were was definitely based in a bit more pragmatism, which is why I thought returning to Bruce made a lot of sense right now. Because here's the thing. This is not the time to get super ambitious and get excited that we have guys like Pulisic. Get excited about the attacking potential that we can have. Because we don't have a back line that's stable, that's dependable, that's there in and out. We're dealing with the passing of a guard in the goalkeeper situation. Goalkeeper used to be our best problem. We used to have two amazing guys to decide between in Brad Friedel and Casey Keller. Now we're approaching a difficult stretch of, you know, who do we go to?
Yeah, what's the plan?
Yeah. And so with that, move forward again. We just said it, center back pairings. I would say pick two guys and give them reps. It's the most important position on the field in terms of nuance and understanding and having a symbiotic relationship. Mm-hmm. You need to know the tendencies, the tells, the weaknesses, the strengths of the guy next to you. So if it's Beisler and Cameron, do it. Do it now and give them the reps. If it's Brooks and Cameron, you know, I know there's been injuries and that's an issue, but pick guys and give them reps. Let them get used to each other. Let the back line develop some continuity. You know, this is a bigger problem because we just don't have the players for these positions. But fullback, a massive issue. Yedlin's pace was missed, but obviously he was injured, so that was a difficult chance. We haven't had a left back, and I mean, holy cow. And I think back through left backs, DeMarcus Beasley, a midfielder converted. Bobby Conve, a midfielder converted. Eddie Lewis, a winger converted. Yeah. You know, that's been a huge problem area. So left back has always plagued us. Right back since Chirondolo's plagued us.
That's what I was going to say. I keep on going back to Steve Chirondolo, the most underrated American player of all time.
Yeah.
He was always there.
Oh, he's excellent.
He was always phenomenal. He was always reliable.
And he was always in the team. So
that's what I mean. Right.
The times I played for the U.S. and you know, I only got 8 caps and probably played 20 or so times for them. But it was always with Chris Armas or Pablo Mascherini, every single time. Mm. And so we knew each other so well. We knew what to expect. We knew how we were going to play. And, you know, go back to those teams. I hear a lot of people say the current permutation of the U.S. team doesn't have enough talent. But I think, is the problem actually there's too much talent? And let me sort of make that argument. The reason that it was always the same players is probably because the depth pool wasn't huge.
And I think Arenas said that as much recently.
Yeah, so there weren't a lot of choices, which is why guys got more minutes together, which is why there was more continuity, which is why the game plan was easier to execute. Wanting to be ambitious right now probably has a lot to do with, listen, there's a lot of guys playing Champions League. I mean, think of, like, we've had Jermaine Jones and Sasha Kljestan and, you know, Michael Bradley was playing at Roma and Clint Dempsey is playing for a top Premier League side. You know, there are a lot of guys that were playing at the highest level, unlike generations before, So you get Jurgen Klinsmann, this larger than life character that promises you that potential, and you start to build towards it. But I just think it's the wrong time to do that without a solid defensive line, because you're going to get exposed. You're going to get exposed when you're trying to be ambitious against, I mean, Costa Rica is the perfect example. That's not even a world power. That's a local power who is a good pressing team, who exploited a game plan that didn't work because of the sloppiness on the ball, the lack of possession, and the defensive frailties that we have. So you can do that. Listen, you can build towards the future and want to be an attacking team if you have the defensive foundation there. But the lack of it makes it irresponsible to try and be so attacking-minded and try to deliver this dream of looking like Spain when we don't really have the ingredients to be that in so many different ways. I'm not even getting into like the development issues of, you know, my coach growing up was my buddy's dad who wore construction boots to the field, Dave Cachetta's dad. I mean, yeah. we laugh. I mean, people might not know. We went to high school together. My coach was a basketball guy that had absolutely no idea soccer was.
He probably knew one rule.
Yeah.
You couldn't use your hands.
Yeah. And then that made him upset because he had a lot of game plans for if we could use our hands. I mean, that's what I had from 5 to like 10. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So like, forget even getting into those nuanced issues of development in this country. That's improving, but far from ideal. We have a lot of players to choose from right now, and I think that combined with a irresponsible ambition to be a team that we're not really set up to be right now, there's struggles. And so I think, again, going back to Bruce, you know, Bruce, I think sometimes with a lack of sophisticated tactical nous and wowing people with schemes and stuff. Yeah, I mean, that's a criticism that's fair, and he's not the guy, and he'll admit it, to build that project. But he is the guy to say, hey, let's like pull back a bit, okay? Because the problem is we have an inverted U going on right now where the better we try to be, the worse we are at the things we used to be good at. So Bruce is kind of saying, you know, the 4-4-2, like simplifying things, it's to say, you're good players. Let's not overthink this thing. Let's simplify the game plan. Let's come up with clear ideas of who's going to play where, based mostly on what they play for their club team, and how we're going to set up against these teams. Now, sometimes he's going to get that wrong, but the good part about it is he's there's this anachronistic approach where he's returning to a lot of what's worked in the past, and that gets us to World Cups. Does that win World Cups? No, it doesn't win the World Cup for U.S., and we shouldn't be worried about that for many years from now. But it gets you to World Cups. And right now, we need a game plan that gets us to a World Cup, because we're looking at two games, basically must wins. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't want to be put in a position where we get fourth and we're playing
Syria or Australia.
Or like what happened to Mexico last time, where, I mean, we're kind of falling into the exact situation that Mexico had, where they relied on us. It was what, Graham? It was Graham Zusi.
Yeah,
gets
Saint,
a massive
Saint Zusi.
Saint Zusi. And then all of a sudden they get that fourth place spot, which was a gift. And then they had to beat, I think, New Zealand in their game to go to the World Cup. I mean, we're in a position where if the U.S. doesn't fix these problems, we're looking at Mexico bailing us out and needing to beat Syria or Australia to go to a World Cup. So forget that. Get behind the team. Get behind the idea that it's not going to look pretty. It's not going to be, you know, it's not going to be your beautiful game that you're hoping for. Is the U.S. capable of that? Absolutely. But achieving that at the cost of making World Cup qualification more difficult is irresponsible. So
get the result.
Get the result. And Panama, by the way, if we make it a physical win the second ball, at times direct and push Panama to have to open up against us and become aggressors, become the ones to push initiatives. If we start strong and get them back on their heels and obviously score early, we dominate that game. We absolutely dominate the game. If we start slow and languid by succumbing to that false hope and that false security of possession that's not getting you anywhere. We're moving the ball around the back line. You know, Panama's not getting a sniff, and all of a sudden, you know, we start to think, okay, we're dominating this game. Kind of like the Costa Rica game, where there were moments at the beginning of that, I thought, man, we look good. This is going to go well. This is going to be a good game. We're getting in behind them. Wood's turning. We're getting Pulisic in good areas. And then all of a sudden, you know, Costa Rica's completely dominating the tactical part of that game, and it had so much to do with just not being set up to play the right way. So, again, I know I'm repeating myself, but Panama don't want it to be pretty. Want it to be what the U.S. is good at, which is being so difficult to beat and showing that the quality will win at the end of the day if the intensity, if the competitive nature of what the U.S. has always brought, which was the foundation of all good performances, whether it be in CONCACAF qualifying or in major tournaments, bring that first and foremost. And then let Pulisic's, let Bradley's, let Dempsey's, let Altidore's, let Wood's, let Nagby's, let some of these guys that have game-changing ability show that they can do that only once we've proved that we deserve the right to play that way.
Okay, beautiful.
You know?
That's a good...
So I'm not... Let's start. I know there was a little bit... Some of this has felt a little bit panicky. This has been a talk us off the ledge sort of podcast.
That was
don't freak out. We've been here before.
And this happens to other countries too.
And our yeah, I mean,
look south of the border.
Yeah,
very south of the border.
Look at Argentina right now. I mean, look at World Cup qualifying for teams that are much better than us that are struggling. Now people will say, well, the U.S. this is an easy group to get out of, and they should be getting out of. You're absolutely right. And to tell you the truth, they're set up to get out of it. Yeah. They're set up to go to the World Cup.
It's a very forgiving process.
They have to win two games that they absolutely can win. One that they absolutely have to and should in Panama, and one that, if you go back to Calgary, remember that shot heard around the world, that maybe we have another magical moment where we get a beautiful goal in Trinidad and Tobago to send the U.S. to a World Cup. But I'm not pessimistic. I'm being critical of us. I'm sort of pointing the microscope on our expectations and just saying, listen, let's just not miss the forest for the trees here. What are we good at, and what position are we in? We're in a position to qualify for a World Cup. We're in a pretty good position. I mean, the last two games we have are very winnable. The last two games for the other teams that are trying to make it to the World Cup are not very winnable. So just relax. Let's take a deep breath here. We're all good, and I'm not going to wear a U.S. jersey for the Panama game. That was a bad idea.
Maybe I'll wear my 1991. It still fits.
I'm going to save mine for the World Cup when we get there in Russia. All right, so that's U.S. That's U.S. soccer stuff.
Quickly, we should hit on a couple other items before we go.
Yeah. You know what? Let's do. There's some deadline day news. So on our recent pod, we had a discussion about, and a little bit of a rant similar to the one I just went on, about the transfer deadline window and how it's absolutely ridiculous that it stays open through the first month of the season and creates all sorts of drama that doesn't need to be there. And it seems that there are some Premier League clubs, there's some Premier League executives listening.
Yeah, we've loyal. We,
thank you for listening.
Yeah,
Richard Scudamore and other major Tad Potters
and
like
all
yourself.
The owners of the clubs over
yes.
there. Yeah,
thank you, Mr. Kroenke and Glazier. So, they've made a decision to, and voted on and passed, the Premier League have, to close the window for the Premier League. So close the window before the first ball is kicked, as we said we wanted to happen. Now, it's not an ultimate sort of panacea. This isn't a solution. It's a step in the right direction. Because what it means is they aren't going to buy. There's no buying players once the season starts. That's it. They're shutting it down. There will be no incoming players. The thing they can't do, which they don't have the power to do, is say there's no selling players. So players can be sold abroad. So the Coutinho situation, for instance, could still be a problem even with this rule passed. The difference is it mitigates that problem, because if you can't buy replacements,
right,
you're much less likely to sell players.
It forces clubs to get their plans in order
right away.
Earlier in the summer.
Especially with a World Cup coming up. Man, yeah. that's going to be a short window.
That's a very good point.
Yeah. So get the business done. Get it done. Do what Manchester United did. Do what Watford did. Do what, Huddersfield did. I mean, do the business right away. Do it at the beginning of the window. Get it done. Many are saying this is going to drive prices up for Premier League teams. Forget that noise. I mean, I don't buy that. I think what's going to happen is it's going to make negotiating easier for Premier League teams because they're going to say, listen, we got this deadline. If are you going to sell us the player before that deadline or not?
Right.
No, you're not? Okay, well, that's fine. And we're going to go with what we got.
Yeah, try to get that price somewhere else.
Yeah, exactly. So, that's the point, is that the Premier League clubs are the ones with the most money. And I don't mean individually. Obviously, PSG and Real Madrid and Barcelona have spending power commensurate with Manchester City and some of the major teams in Premier League. But top to bottom, Premier League are spending the dough.
Yeah.
So, closing their doors is basically taking the richest buyer off the market and leaving teams to try and go get second bids. So I think it's a great move. It moves us to not having to deal with what we're going to deal with this weekend, which is Van Dijk with Southampton, finally back in first team training. How does that go? Mm-hmm. Does he play? Does he get reintegrated to the team? Coutinho, back in first team training. His lower back injury has healed remarkably when he left for Brazil. It's just they've got some insane physios there. Diego Costa, he didn't get his move. So what happens with that? So there are lingering issues now that are going to play out over the next couple months that would have been resolved and would have been moot when the season started based on this rule. So moving forward, well done. Well done, Premier League, for making that choice. And we'll see if that's a statement that causes other leagues to domino effect.
Yeah. Let's hope so.
So, so it's a big weekend for Premier League. I'm off. I'm going to be maybe I'm going to go to a bar, watch the game. I haven't done that in a while. And watch the first early games is the Man City Liverpool.
Yeah, that's the
one to go catch at the bar. So, Dad Potters, hit me up on Twitter. Let me know where you're going to be at Kyle Martino. Thanks for listening. Keep those reviews coming. And also, Tad Potters, you know it. Stay on your feet.